This is Video History Planning Meeting, July 30th, Tape 2. You can get these cassettes, you can get 90-minute cassettes.
Well, Joe, that pretty well sketches out.
Tape's thin.
What we have in the gallery, is that right?
That sketches out what we have in the gallery, except for one other artifact, and that is a rocket camera from GE that was flown on a Thor in 1959. It was the first to provide motion pictures of the Earth's surface from an altitude greater than 300 miles. Why they felt them, I guess they were looking for a first.
What year was that?
1959. And this is section 320. Label 3.
I guess I want to get a sense from Merton Amram of the cameras or systems that they had significant contributions to that we should discuss in this setting in the gallery.
Well,
it doesn't mean that we have to have the artifact there, but these provide just kind of a historical backdrop for such a discussion.
About this?
Not sure. We wanted to plan it out in a little more detail with you two first to get a better sense of where we were going to go with it.
You see that we have a meeting the night before, informal.
Yes.
And we lay out the number of spots you want to talk about. How many spots we have now?
Essentially three, isn't that right, Joe?
Yeah, this is actually, we've got one, two, three, four, and it's the Hayek camera, the K-series of cameras, the U2 camera, and Discoverer 13. And all of these here...
That's a good day's work.
Well, yeah, they're all underneath the U2.
What was the conclusion of our discussion about the K-series? That it would be worthwhile to talk about those, or that there wasn't enough personal involvement of the people who were going to be in the video history to warrant extensive
That's where
discussion?
Lighthorn and Silberg fought the war with the K-cameras. All the pictures taken during World War II were taken with the K-cameras.
Now, do they...
Plus the Sony camera. Very minor use.
Do they lead in any way to the Hayek? Are they related?
No.
Technologically?
No.
To the duplex? No.
Well, the duplex, I would think so.
Duplex is made of two K-17s.
Two K-17s, and, I mean, that's the design came from the K-17, basically. It was like a trimetric gun, only two instead of three. And combined into essentially a single camera instead of three separate cameras.
K-17 with a 6-inch camera, guns on it. 9x9 covered 76 degrees side to side, 93 degrees corner to corner. The TriMet installation was a vertical camera, two oblique cameras, covered horizon to horizon.
Well,
something on night photography?
On night photography?
Yeah.
We do have several photos in there. We've got one of George Goddard's nighttime photographs with phosphorus bomb. Magnesium. Phosphorus. Magnesium bomb. We've got some nighttime photographs with city lights, but I believe they're satellite photos. So the question is that the in terms of the types of things that both of you grappled with during the 1950s, do the K series of cameras fit in any way as background?
Not for me. Amram was at Wright Field. They were the operational cameras of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And Korea, they were just being flown, you know, for daily,
right.
Daily kind of bread and
butter. Or long range of light photography. Just the game cameras, but long lenses for that.
Mm-hmm.
Photographing across borders. That's before they flew vertically, through overflight. You need to fly.
I would think that, for instance, one of the main themes that could be interesting would be a discussion of the origins, like of the Hayek camera, and like our meeting in, was it January or February of 57, where Baker was there. Four of us were there.
Is this the Boston meeting?
Boston meeting.
Earlier?
And Levison told us detail about the duplex. And the origins of that, some of its history. His thinking of his new camera, which led to the Hayek, but it wasn't the Hayek.
It's a fascinating story.
And
but it illustrates the enormous utility of having free flow between guys in industry, guys in laboratories, guys in government.
Good, that's marvelous.
We wrote that up in our report. tried to in detail. I'm not sure how much of it Levison would agree with. I'm not sure. You know, you.
Yeah. Now, what was it that was
I mean, a bit of difference of a view of how the thing happened is fine. I mean, we're not, you know, looking to have a consensus on it. I mean, I think it just
we're
points out.
Our viewpoint's the right one.
We understand that, Amram.
And this led to, you know, in the 57s to our spin-stabilized camera.
Mm-hmm.
And to Levison's Hayek design.
Now, the missing link that we're talking about that led to the spin-stabilized camera and Levison's Hayek design
was meeting in Washington at the American Society of Photogrammetry that Amram and I went to, and we had a talk with Fred Wilcox there. And he showed us some of Fairchild's camera designs, which are panoramic cameras for the wingtip of a Ryan aircraft, in which the whole camera essentially rotated within a shell. And I've got the actual drawings that he showed us in 57. These things.
Would it be reasonable to include those in this discussion?
You know, we could. That's why I mentioned it. Mm-hmm. I mean, one wanted to talk about this as a theme. I think we could do that. And That led, because we'd been talking at RAND so much about spin-stabilized satellites, and for the reason that people like Buckheim and Clement were on some of these panels, like the Stewart Committee, and during that period we were extremely concerned about our program because we had so many failures. Just one after another, and the whole question of getting reliability was becoming very serious because the costs were high. We were following the philosophy of the Germans, who during their V2, if you remember, they designed a thing, took it out and flew it. They had almost no telemetry, so when they'd have an accident, they didn't really know what went wrong or why. And particularly with a control system, it was very difficult to design. They did not have inertial systems. We didn't have many gyroscopes and any of these kinds of things. Primary development were for aircraft, autopilots. And to go from that to a guidance system was quite a big step. So there was lots of problems, and the RAND engineer is typically Buckheim, and his group came to the conclusion that we could develop reliable spin-stabilized satellites or rockets much faster and sooner than we could three-axis stabilized systems. And so I was familiar with this kind of a discussion and argument going on around RAND. They were looking for how can we get these things to be reliable soon. They felt a real pressure of time. And in fact, for instance, the first Thor with a second stage flew. The Vanguard second stage, and went to ICBM range. This is the first test of a re-entry system at full range. There was the thought, well, we could convert that into an ICBM right now and have not wait for the Atlas to come, which was
called a Thorid.
And it was having lots of trouble. This was seriously being studied at RAND, whether we should or should not recommend this to the Air Force. So I was familiar with this kind of discussion. And so when I saw this rotating camera inside this box, it just seemed to me it was a terribly ugly, useless kind of camera. But all of a sudden, when you say instead of rotating inside mechanically, you put it inside a spinning spacecraft, why then it became sort of a natural and a very efficient way to develop a panoramic camera. And so, you know, we talked about that a good deal when we came back from this meeting in Washington. And we also were discussing Leveson's design of the HIAC.
Awesome.
Which was, well, that was after that meeting. We were discussing it because he was using the spherical shell lens and the shutter was moving across it.
In the high axis.
It was moving the 2¼-inch across the film.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole shutter movement. And so I think it was Amram or myself, I can't remember, said, well, gee, it would be, we were talking then about a panoramic camera, you see, and said, well, why not run the shutter the other way, the length of the thing, and run it as a panoramic camera rather than as a frame camera. And that was when Amram telephoned Leveson and wrote him a message to look into panoramic camera as a possibility.
He was in the hospital.
And he schemed out, yeah, it would be more efficient because you'd use a narrow angle lens then rather than this wide angle lens. And that rocking system was what he thought out and led to the Hayek camera design. And he came out here, as a matter of fact, and spent a week or two on the beach right down here. We saw him about every day. Remember that?
Recuperating
from his symptoms. And that's when he went back and they built the Hayek. And he, Baker had been talking about using the microfile film. He had been testing it in his basement of his house. And it was clear that it would be very interesting as an aerial film. So Leveson designed the camera for the microfile film.
He designed the Hayek
for that
for film. The film that Baker had
tested, and actually Eastman came out with a modification. The original microfile was blue sensitive but not red sensitive. And of course we put a yellow filter in there to knock out all the blue, because that's the blue haze in the atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
It's called a minus blue filter. And E.K. was very interested in developing it as an aerial film. And that led to the SO-243 film and some of their other, I guess the SO designation was special order.
Okay. Well, I think we've clearly got a lot to talk about.
Now, that could be, I think, an interesting discussion.
Definitely.
To me, that's one of the main themes that this group of people have to talk about. In terms of the U2, I think Baker is the only person of us who was actually a part of the development of the camera and flying it. I think the history is important to review. I think it can be told. I think the decisions process for building it did come out of the Killian committees.
Baker had a dual role. One was a detailed scientific designer. The other is formulating policy. Because in 1954, Baker made a trip to Europe in his capacity as chairman of the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board panel on reconnaissance and intelligence. I went with him on that trip. He wasn't talking lens design, he was talking broad concepts. Came back from that trip and did his experimental work in the basement. We were both very impressed with the haze in there, industrial smoke, low contrast of stuff. Baker started fooling around with high contrast film. And the only reason he tried it, he misread the speed of the film. He said if he didn't know how slow it was, he never would have tried it.
This is when he was experimenting in the basement, the glass screen and the contrast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not confident how to handle this U2 thing, how to do it comfortably. And the Discover thing begins to get into an area that's sufficiently sensitive that I'm not sure who of us can say anything.
Amro?
Say good night.
Yeah, that's
it. You know, I mean, which is too bad, but I just wouldn't know how to handle the discussion.
Yeah, we don't want it. Yeah.
And so I think that that would be awkward.
Who got Red Shepherd's address? No.
Red Shepherd?
Yeah.
No.
Mono's address? I'm trying to find it.
Let me
camera, you see basically two primary useful discussion areas. One, the principal one around the HIAC, and then secondarily around the
two. Yeah, and this is why I was trying to think about this thing, like bringing in a spot picture of Turret Tom, and, you know, and say this is what's really there, because otherwise if you see that 59 picture, it doesn't mean much to many people who never know. They don't know what a launch pad looks like, perhaps. And some of these aerial photographs, if you're not accustomed to aerial photographs and looking at them. You talk about the one in San Diego. I think if that's the one I remember, there's a parking lot of Convair there, and you can see the strips of, you know, indicating the parking slots, which give you an idea about the resolution.
That's the address and phone number as of November 22nd, 83, which is on this. Now, one of the things that we were looking at, using the Looking at Earth Gallery as a setting for this. What's that?
Somebody else's phone.
We're looking at using the gallery as a setting for the video history, but we didn't feel that we had to absolutely tie ourselves down to always using what was in there. And so that if you'd rather not talk directly about Discoverer. What else can we talk about in that context of the gallery and in the context of your relationship and the work that you did together at RAND?
Well, there is the Lunar Orbiter exhibit. Said in detail about the origins of that lunar orbiter program. There are ties of the camera system to some of the Air Force systems. I don't know if this relationship can be discussed or not.
One of our colleagues.
Sure that you've heard about it. I don't know, and it's mentioned on a few occasions, but I haven't seen anything, you know, any histories which covered that.
There was a proposal to take the fifth lunar orbiter, which is now sitting in the museum. There was once a proposal to put that spacecraft into Earth orbit and use it to photograph the Earth, and the request was denied at some high level in the security establishment, where they would allow the technology to be used to map the moon, but they would not allow that to be put in orbit around the world. A friend of ours who's doing work with Stria Landsat has come across correspondence, some of the correspondence involved in that.
Yeah, so not surprising.
That's one of the smarter decisions.
So there's there is an official NASA history on the lunar orbiter. It started when by what's now TRW. could go back. JPL had a had their surveyor program with Hughes. And there were two parts of it. The surveyor lander, which was to be followed by a surveyor orbiter. And the JPL designs of this orbiter used Vidicon cameras, and they were really terribly poor. I saw some of them at the time, and they were very bad proposals, and they were to use the same surveyor spacecraft, which was the lander, and the Centaur stage. Well, in the early 60s, that Centaur got was developed very slowly, and the surveyor mission was slow being launched because of the trouble with the Centaur. And STL, Space Technology Laboratories, came up with a proposal and took it to NASA for using a spin-stabilized spacecraft. Particularly in those days, you could always tell a company by the kind of spacecraft they designed. Basically, Hughes and STL were using spin-stabilized spacecraft, and JPL always used a star system. Lockheed always used the horizon sensor. And these engineers, you know, they always, and the Russians always used pressure vessels. You could tell the designers almost,
yeah.
You know, the engineering philosophy of these different organizations. And it was like Amram used to tell me, you know, take your problem to a shoe manufacturer, the solution comes back looking like a shoe. And so if you go to STL for a spacecraft, it's going to come back, spin stabilized, and you know what it looked like,
yeah.
And so forth. And it was this way. Well, STL went to NASA and with a proposal to build a lunar orbiter with the Agena booster, which was Air Force was already flying, and was available. But it was a lot. It would put a lot less mass into lunar orbit. But they built a lightweight spacecraft that way. And it was spin stabilized. It had a spinning panoramic camera and processed the film on board, sent it back to Earth. Then the Apollo mission started to overtake those proposals. And the orbiter was being modified to support the Apollo landing, and the requirements were defined in that manner. Well, this STL proposal that looked so very good when it came to getting pictures in a hurry didn't look quite so useful when they had to meet the very specific specifications for the Apollo landing. Anyway, they had the competition then. STL, Hughes, and Boeing. And Boeing came in with a three-axis stabilized spacecraft. Lightweight one, which would all, they would all three use the Agena. Both Hughes and STL came in with spinning panoramic cameras, and Boeing came in with a stabilized camera, and with an Eastman Kodak camera, CBS readout system, and it was the best system, and it, of course, flew very nicely. I don't know, again, it's not a thing that we had first-hand information on. you have a V-2 there. Now, in the early days of RAND, we studied that the V-2. We had, I think, a complete file on everything that was learned and known about the U-2, the V-2, and their designs. It's called the A-4, the A-9, and the A-10.